Now I'll introduce the speaker, who's Lily. She's the education officer here at Sydney University. You might have seen her on Sky News. You might have seen her also, waging a campaign to bring down Western civilization on this campus. So at the forefront of that. And she'll be speaking for roughly 30 minutes or so. Afterwards, there will be time for discussion, and we can do that then. But for now, please give a warm welcome, a round of applause to Lily.
Cool. Thanks heaps, Chris. Well, recently people might have seen that there was a multi-million dollar documentary series made on the Vietnam War by famous filmmaker Ken Burns. This is now being broadcast across the whole world. I really like the documentary in a lot of ways, but unfortunately I think it starts with the following analysis. Ken Burns says that America's involvement in Vietnam began in secrecy. It ended 30 years later in failure witnessed by the entire world. It was begun in good faith by decent people out of fateful misunderstanding. I'll repeat that last bit. It was begun in good faith by decent people out of fateful misunderstanding. And I think this really frames the Vietnam War as the exception to the rule, a terrible mistake and a dark chapter in an otherwise pretty peaceful and happy-go-lucky kind of world. And I think this is exactly how the ruling class would like the world to remember the horrors of Vietnam. Instead, I think it's of crucial importance to see the Vietnam War not as an aberration, but instead part of the fundamental logic of the criminal and brutal system that we live in. The war exposed the most horrific face of capitalism, truly, with a combined death toll of over 5 million people. 5 million who were killed in previously untested methods of slaughter. And it was led not by fringe maniacs, like, the Donald Trumps of the world, but instead by the supposedly free and democratic United States, led by the liberal democratic hero John F. Kennedy, and then by his successor Lyndon Johnson. They launched a war against an oppressed people who were demanding freedom and national liberation. And they did so not just because they had a particular affinity for killing innocent people, but because it was necessary to maintain the position of the United States at the apex of the imperial world order. And I think even when it became really very, very clear, which it was from very early on, that the US could not win this war, they continued to kill, and not just in Vietnam as well. They continued to kill hundreds of thousands of people in Cambodia and Laos as well. And I think this kind of barbarity is the logical outcome of this rotten system that is built on endless expansion, competition, and vicious imperial domination. But the people's history of the Vietnam War is also about recognising and celebrating resistance. It's not all about horror. As the war dragged on, millions of people fought back. And from the heroic struggle that was waged by the peasants in Vietnam to the soldiers at the front lines and students and workers on the streets, together they toppled the greatest military machine that the world has ever seen. It's pretty inspiring stuff. From the era of the Vietnam War as well, a new left was born, and these people recognised that the war was the symptom, but capitalism was the disease, and really the only solution was a socialist society. And issues of race and democracy and power combined with the anti-war movement in the 60s and 70s to create a mass radicalisation that shook the foundations of this system. So first, I kind of want to give a bit of a historical backdrop to the war in Vietnam, because American involvement in Vietnam did not start with the invasion in 1965. American involvement in Vietnam started, I think, really when the Second World War ended in 1945. America at that point came out of the Second World War as kind of the top dog, I guess. And they saw it necessary to fund their ally, France, to help them regain their former colony that they had lost in the war. That was Indochina at the time. They wanted to regain it from the communist-led Viet Minh, who were the liberation forces there. And the US knew that if the independence movement succeeded in Indochina, it would be an inspiration to oppress people everywhere, which would be a serious threat to the post-war world order that was totally dominated by the US. So the French war to regain Indochina went on for 9 years, and by the time of their defeat at the hands of the Viet Minh in 1954, the US Army was financing 80% of the French war effort. That was how much they wanted Indochina to be recolonized by the brutal French system. So when the French were then defeated by the Viet Minh, which was a really sweet victory, The world's major powers met at the Geneva Conference in 1954, and it was decided and agreed between these parasites that Vietnam would be divided into two along the 17th parallel and with a demilitarized zone between the north and south. And this was supposed to be a temporary divide. The country would eventually be reunified, supposedly, but that would be at the elections in 2 years' time, so just hold off for a sec. But, of course, the US never wanted to abide by these accords. They never signed any agreements because they knew that in any freely held election in Vietnam that Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh would win at least by 80%. So this is the US Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, and this is Vietnam as it was decided in 1954, the Geneva Conference. So Indochina, which was originally this whole peninsula minus Thailand, Laos was granted independence, Cambodia as well, and Vietnam was divided into two. So as soon as the Geneva Conference ended, the US set out to stop the mandated elections, and in a very well-practiced strategy, they installed a new president of South Vietnam. And from the remnants of the brutal French colonial system that I mentioned before, they built up a brutal, quasi-fascist and deeply corrupt dictatorship around Diem. He unleashed a wave of terror against supporters of the Viet Minh, and tens of thousands of people were jailed, killed, and all of the land that had been redistributed was given back to all of the rich landlords. He was so corrupt that he held a rigged referendum and bragged about him winning 98.2% of the vote. He was an open sympathiser as well of Franco's fascist dictatorship in Spain, and his brother, who was the chief of police in charge of killing all of the Viet Minh, was an open supporter of Hitler. And this regime that the US totally backed, staffed and defended actually proved so unpopular and unstable that the opposition forces of the Viet Minh and their supporters grew steadily, actually in opposition to the South Vietnamese government. And by the end of 1963, the Kennedy administration decided, OK, Diem's a bit of a political liability, let's get rid of him now. And they had to do that in order to stop the fall of the Saigon government. But despite them removing the Diem family, the government continued to spiral downwards, and the revolutionary movement that was led by the NLF then continued to move forward. So by mid-1964, so just before the war properly started, the NLF controlled 40 to 50% of the South Vietnamese countryside, which is pretty amazing. So in 1965, when the war properly starts, the US faces a serious choice. You can either get out now and be seen to lose to the whole world, or you can really go to war. And I think for a lot of reasons, the American ruling class really did not want to lose. So for one, losing in Vietnam, I think, is not often talked about, but it would weaken the program of anti-communism within America. Anti-communism had been a very useful ideological tool for crushing the domestic workers' movement in the US. And I think the American ruling class were pretty afraid of the confidence of that a defeat at the hands of the North Vietnamese would give to communists and the radicalizing civil rights movement within the US, and they couldn't really deal with that. I think as well a defeat in Vietnam would weaken the position of America on the world stage. It would weaken the position of all of the different regimes that America backed across the world and strengthen all of their respective national liberation movements. Losing would have also meant showing weakness in the Cold War against the USSR, and the USSR was another powerful imperial force that was competing with the US for control over the whole globe. So I think due to a combination of these factors and a few more as well, Lyndon Johnson decided to send in the Marines to Vietnam in the spring of 1965, and the American War in Vietnam officially began. Cool. So that's him with Diem, pretty gross. That was when he was still the vice president, so that's in 1961 when it comes out that Diem is a supporter of fascists in Spain. So I think a lot of prominent histories of the Vietnam War have a tendency, I think, to underemphasize just the extreme horrors, really, that were inflicted upon the Vietnamese people. As the US faced off against guerrillas who were armed with old rifles and homemade grenades that were made out of Coca-Cola cans, the United States had at its disposal more killing power, destructive force, and advanced technology than any military in the entire world. And the total munitions that were unleashed by the US in Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia added up to the equivalent of 640 Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs. That was the scale. So nearly 2 million civilians and over 1 million NLF fighters were killed in the war. And in North Vietnam in particular, the American war targeted schools and hospitals and churches, and they rained down cluster bombs on the population to cause as much damage as possible. I think perhaps most horrendously, and obviously famously as well, the US employed chemical weapons in a way never seen before Vietnam. Their weapons of choice were Agent Orange, white phosphorus, and of course napalm. Napalm is a gelatinous petrol-based substance that burns at temperatures of 800 degrees centigrade, and an American pilot explained its use quite well, I think. He said the original product wasn't so hot. If the gooks were quick, they could scrape it off. So the backroom boys at Dow started adding polystyrene, and now it sticks like shit to a blanket. But then if the gooks jumped underwater, it stopped burning, so they started adding white phosphorus so as to make it burn better. And it'll even burn underwater now, and it'll keep burning right down to the bone. Chemical weapons also left a horrific long-term effect in the country as well. So often not included in the death count is the additional 3 million Vietnamese people who suffered major illnesses due to exposure to Agent Orange too. And this figure also does not include their children, who still to today suffer the side effects of Agent Orange. And this is just some of the effects that it can cause in Vietnamese children in an orphanage. This was the explicit strategy of the US in Vietnam. Their hope was that the Vietnamese population would turn to the leadership of the NLF and just demand a surrender. But the opposite happened, and they knew this from the very beginning. Because as the US and American forces continued to brutalise the population of Vietnam, the more and more they turned towards the NLF and towards freedom. So William Earhart, who was a US Marine, explained it, I think, quite well. He said, they'd be beaten pretty badly, maybe tortured, maybe they'd be hauled off to jail, and God knows what would happen to them. And at the end of the day, the villages would be turned loose, their homes had been wrecked, their chickens killed, their rice confiscated. And if they weren't pro-Viet Cong but before we got there, they sure as hell were by the time we left. So I think the Vietnam War is obviously a history of this just utter horror and of rape and atrocity. But it's also a story of really quite unimaginable courage, really endless courage and resistance. And I think there were three kind of main strands of the movement across the world that ended up defeating the American ruling class. And this was the Vietnamese Peasant Revolt, the American anti-war movement as well, and the GI Revolt. Definitely, I think, the greatest of these was the Peasant Revolt, so the fight that the Vietnamese waged themselves against the American oppressors. Hundreds of thousands of guerrilla fighters gave their lives, and millions of peasants died in what was truly a heroic fight for national liberation. And I really think their victory is testament to what is possible when ordinary people can come together. Men, women, children, ordinary, poor, oppressed people of the world to fight for a world of decency and a fair share of what is really theirs. So for the Vietnamese, what they call the American War was only the last hurdle of an 80-year struggle for national liberation. And I think the tunnels of Cu Chi, which I've got up here on the wall, I'm not sure if I said that right, sorry. they really give a wonderful idea of the courage of the Vietnamese resistance. So these tunnels were originally dug in the 1940s. That was back when the Viet Minh were fighting the French. And they were dug to be hiding places for the guerrillas and also bomb shelters for the villages. So when the American War began, they opened up the tunnels again. And the Viet Cong dug more tunnels and more tunnels and began to link them together until you have hundreds of miles of connected tunnels underground. And they lived in these tunnels for years underground. They dug rooms in which to sleep, eat, carry out medical procedures, hold organising meetings, literally everything. It's pretty amazing. You can see a couple of the different layout rooms there. I think as well, there's just so many stories, actually millions and millions of stories that you could tell and examples of the incredible bravery of the Vietnamese. But one really stuck with me when I was doing research, and it was one that Jonathan Neal told in his book called The American War. He tells the story of Vo Thi Mo, who is a Viet Cong woman of the tunnels. He says, when the Americans came and bulldozed her village, Vo Thi Mo went into the tunnels and became a platoon leader. One night she was on guard at the tunnel entrance when three American soldiers sat down nearby. They could not see her, and she paused out of curiosity to watch and to listen to them. The American soldiers shared cookies and sweets with each other. They took out their letters from home and read them aloud, crying together in the dark, and she froze. They do what we do, she thought. Her company messenger, who was crouched down next to her, raised his gun to shoot the Americans, and she silently knocked his gun away. The guerrillas the next day held an inquiry into Votimo, as she had not done her duty, but her platoon messenger testified passionately in her defence. Together, the two had been through many battles, she leading her platoon of 24 women, him, the messenger, running back and forth constantly through the bullets. Her platoon messenger, he worshipped Votimo, who had been in the army for that, at that point 4 years, and him only one. The court-martial listened to the messenger and let Votimo off with only a reprimand. Votimo was just 17 years old, and her platoon messenger was 10. In fact, many of the guerrilla fighters in Vietnam were women and children who saw no other option but to risk everything they had for the cause of freedom from occupation. I think it was partially this tireless resistance and the nobility of the Vietnamese and the violence inflicted upon them as well that sparked a global anti-war movement. So soldiers would return from the war, from Vietnam, and tell their families that the only force worthy of respect on the battle lines was the Vietnamese. And the anti-war movement really created an enormous political crisis for the ruling classes across the world, and this fed the revolutionary fervour that I don't think we've seen since. I'm covering up my slide button. Cool. So in America, much of the anti-war movement was led by students. In 1965, in response to President Johnson sending the troops into Vietnam, a group of faculty at the University of Michigan organised the first teach-in. And it was scheduled to begin at 8 p.m. after classes had ended and continue as long as necessary. The next day, 3,000 students showed up and debated the war until 8 a.m. the next morning. In the months that followed, more than 100 colleges held similar events. And this is a photograph of the largest teach-in, which it was, of course, at UC Berkeley, which involved 36,000 students. They assembled in a teach-in that lasted 36 hours, and many different anti-war activists from all around the country came to speak to them. When the teach-in started as well, the government established a truth team. People might have heard of these guys, to tour the country and go to the different teach-ins and try and defend the government and the foreign policy of the US. And often as well, the student activists invited the truth team along to come and try and debate them. At literally every stop, the official representatives of the government were defeated, and they were totally unable to defend the foreign policy to the assembled students. One interesting story as well is this guy who was an early participant at one of the teach-ins, and his name was Daniel Ellsberg. He was a young assistant in the State Department, and he himself could not defend the US foreign policy in 1965 when they invaded the Dominican Republic. Daniel Ellsberg, people might know, later went on to release the Pentagon Papers, and this exposed Washington's long history of violence and deceit in Vietnam. In his memoirs, he wrote, "I lay in bed and thought, this is the system that I have been working for, the system that I have been a part of, and it's a system that lies automatically at every level from bottom to top to conceal murder." And the government's truth team, not long afterwards, disbanded, and they were never heard from again, funnily enough. So for thousands of students, I think these teach-ins, early demonstrations, were pretty eye-opening. It was a growing realisation, I think, amongst thousands of students that this was not a war for the liberation of Vietnam, but that was quite a shock. I think people grew up believing in the ideas of the Cold War, that the US was a force for good in the world against the evil forces of communism, etc. But then people began to realise, well, this is not the exception, but the rule. This is what the US does all across the world. And I think Paul Potter really well encapsulated... Paul Potter really encapsulated this well in a speech that he gave in April 1965. It was one of the first anti-war marches on Washington. They expected kind of a couple thousand people to come along. On the day, 20,000 people turned up. And he gave this excellent speech called Rebels with a Cause. He said, "Most of us grew up thinking that the United States was a strong but humble nation that respected the integrity of other nations and other systems, and that engaged in war only as a last resort. But the incredible war in Vietnam has provided the razor, the terrifying, sharp cutting edge that has finally severed the last vestige of illusion that morality and democracy are the guiding principles of American foreign policy. What kind of system is it that justifies the United States or any country seizing the destinies of the Vietnamese people and using them callously for its own purposes, that consistently puts material values before human values and still persists in calling itself free, and still persists in finding itself fit to police the world. We must name that system, we must name it, describe it, analyse it, understand it, and change it. So Chapters for Students for a Democratic Society, which Paul Potter was the president of, popped up everywhere. And they organised a series of direct actions aimed at not just protesting the war, but also disrupting the war machine, which is pretty cool. And one of these such actions was at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 1967, where a protest was organised against Dow Chemical, who were recruiting on campus. Dow Chemical is the largest producer of napalm in the world. University administrators called in the police, who then attacked the demonstrators brutally. They unleashed tear gas on the student protesters. They broke windows and hauled students through the broken glass. And there was blood literally all over the steps of the university. And this is one of the photographs that I think is pretty powerful from the time. And similar protests occurred at campuses all across the country, and everywhere they were attacked by university administrations and the police. Most famously, of course, there was the Kent State Massacre in Ohio in 1970, in which the National Guard was sent onto university campus to crush an anti-war protest, and they shot and killed four students for the crime of opposing the Vietnam War. At this point, I think, when the violence began to really crack down on the movement, thousands of students were pushed into the anti-war movement. And I think many people thought, like, if this is what they're willing to do to white American college students, middle-class kids, well, what on earth are they doing over there to the poor Vietnamese? In Australia as well, our little corner of the world definitely had some cool moments in the anti-war movement too. It had a large presence on Australian campuses and was somewhat inspired as well by the American anti-war movement, but also by the crimes of our own government in Vietnam. So Australian students established their own SDS. These photos are from Sydney University, so literally just outside, which is pretty cool. So here, students hid draft dodges in the student union building. They publicly filled in fake conscription papers, often with the names of Liberal Party politicians, which is pretty good. And they also staged mass burn-ins of draft papers. But in Australia as well, it's worth saying that the trade union movement was much stronger than in America and played a greater role in the anti-war movement. So in 1965, approximately 2,500 workers, waterside workers in Melbourne, walked off the wharves to protest against Menzies' decision to send troops. And 500 seamen, waterside workers and ship's painters also protested and picketed the American embassy in Brisbane. The trade unions, I think, as well, gave the anti-war movement quite a bit of muscle that it may not have otherwise had. And they were really able to argue to a greater section of the population that the Vietnam War was not just a question of morality and right and wrong, but it was a question of class. The Vietnam War was a rich man's war that poor people and workers were being sent to die for, and they wouldn't stand for it. Then it kind of all changes. In January 1968, the Tet Offensive is launched, and it really shifts things up. It's a shattering defeat for both the guerrilla fighters in Vietnam and also for the US ruling class. Tet was a coordinated attack by the NLF forces, and it took place in 140 cities and towns all across the country. And 100 targets were hit just in South Vietnam alone, and that included the American embassy in Saigon, as well as Hue, the ancient capital of Vietnam, which fell to the NLF forces. But an incredible force of American firepower pushed back the Tet Offensive. This is what that looked like. Newspapers across the world carried a quote from the officer in charge of the retaliation to the Tet Offensive. He said it became necessary to destroy the town in order to save it. And really, destroy they did. That was the policy of the Americans. They decimated entire cities from the sky. But this really came at a price, too, for them, because Tet was a dramatic political turning point in the war, and the horror of the US retaliation was widely broadcast. This is a very famous photograph that was sent across the world. And I think more and more people realised that they'd been lied to for years. There was no light at the end of the tunnel. This wasn't a war that America could win. But more than that as well, the Americans were the bad guys, and this really started to kick off, I think, after 1968. So the peace movement in the US and Australia and around the world at this point radicalised, and more people were drawn to demonstrations than ever before. Those who were already involved in the movement began to draw some sharper conclusions and called not just for peace, but for the success of the or victory of the National Liberation Front. And I think Tet was also such an embarrassing show of weakness to the Americans that it led to Johnson's refusal to stand for a second term as president and forced Richard Nixon, who was a Republican, to run as an anti-war candidate, which was obviously a blatant lie. But just before the Tet Offensive as well, I wanted to mention, in 1967, an organization called Vietnam Veterans Against the War was formed. And going forward, I think it also gave the peace movement another real sense of legitimacy against right-wingers who said, oh, you know, these students, they're all going out, they're against the soldiers who are on the front lines. But Vietnam Veterans Against the War argued that the anti-war movement wasn't fighting against the workers in uniform being sent to war. They were fighting for them and fighting for their rights and dignity. So most famously, in 1971, 2,000 veterans marched on the Capitol, and one by one they stepped up to throw their medals back at Congress, which is, yeah, really quite remarkable to watch. This one guy, Ron Ferrizzi, who features in Ken Burns' recent documentary, he was from Philadelphia, and he announced as he threw his medals back to the steps of Congress, "My wife is divorcing me for returning these medals. She wants me to keep them so my sons can be proud of me for something. But three of my best friends died so I could get that medal. We're not going to fight anymore, but if we have to fight again, it will be to take these steps." Yeah, fucking cool. In Vietnam, the US military faced an enormous problem after 1968 as well, which was the Soldiers' Revolt. So from the Long Binh Jail in Vietnam to the Travis Air Force Base in California, the aircraft carriers in the South China Sea, the armed forces of the United States faced widespread resistance and unrest, morale and discipline sinking to record lows. And by 1969, the armed forces began to be withdrawn for the very survival of the US war effort, actually. This is a really great quote from this, like, not particularly leftist fella. His name's Colonel Robert Heinel, and he wrote in the Armed Forces Journal in 1971, "By every conceivable indicator, our army that now remains in Vietnam is in a state approaching collapse, with individual units avoiding or having refused combat, murdering their officers and non-commissioned officers, drug-ridden, dispirited, where not near mutinous. At best count, there appear to be some 144 underground newspapers published on or aimed at US military bases in this country and overseas. And these journals are not mere gripe sheets. In Vietnam, writes one, the officers are the true enemy, not the enemy. At least 14 GI dissent organizations now operate more or less openly." So all of the foregoing facts point to widespread conditions amongst the American forces in Vietnam that have only been exceeded in this century by the collapse of the Tsarist armies in 1916 and 17. At this point, Robert Heinel is making reference to the Russian Revolution, and that was what he was really pretty terrified of, I think, at this point. So soldiers in Vietnam began to write UUU on their helmet liners, and that meant the unwilling, led by the unqualified, doing the unnecessary for the ungrateful. Unauthorized absence rates reached unprecedented levels, and in the army in 1971, there were 17 AWOLs and 7 desertions for every 100 soldiers. And they published a lot of papers like this, which is pretty cool if you want to have a little bit of a read. They distribute to agitate against the war, and they had a list of demands. A lot of them were pretty amazing. Harsher forms of rebellion, though, also occurred. I think that's pretty clear. Soldiers, for them, pacifism is not really an option. If you refuse to fight in a war, you face the threat of being shot or court-martialed. Soldiers who want to stop a war and also stay alive often have to be prepared to shoot their officers, because their officers are definitely prepared to shoot them. So violent uprisings, refusal of orders, and the practice of fragging, which was murdering gung-ho officers and sergeants who repeatedly would send soldiers out on dangerous patrols, was pretty widespread. And this made the American Army chain of command totally inoperable. And the cumulative result of this resistance within the ranks meant a severe breakdown of the military effectiveness of the American Army. Wanted to mention as well, the strongest and most militant resistors to the Vietnam War were the black GIs. They consistently faced the most injustice, I think, within the war. They faced greater oppression in the military than the whites, but this meant that they fought back with greater determination and anger. Many of the black soldiers came from big cities in America that had rioted in the 60s, and with them they brought the politics of black nationalism into the army. Their racial oppression, I think, really shaped their opposition to the war as well, and I think many resonated with Muhammad Ali's words. He said, "The draft is about white people sending black people to fight yellow people to protect the country that they stole from the red people." In other words, why should black GIs risk death to defend freedom in Vietnam when they were being denied basic rights back at home? So blacks in Vietnam formed these amazing solidarity groups and rap clubs, They became often centres of political resistance, and these resistance activities had an enormous impact on the American military and played, I think, a really crucial impact in speeding up the end of the war. This is a photograph of one such group. This is called the Black Liberation Front of the Armed Forces. They were inspired by the Black Panthers. And in 1971, they staged a demonstration in Vietnam to commemorate the birthday of the late Martin Luther King Jr. And together they chanted to free Angela Davis and free all of the brothers in Long Binh Jail. So eventually the combination, I think, of all of these different strands, the GI rebellion, the domestic radicalization, and also the undying resistance of the Vietnamese people, meant that the war in Vietnam just couldn't sustain. So in 1973, Washington folded, and they signed a peace deal in Paris. They agreed to remove all the American troops, and by 1975, the North Vietnamese army conquered the American puppet state of South Vietnam with pretty limited effort, actually. The conscripts Vietnamese army in South Vietnam, they totally fell apart. They had no reason to fight anymore. And this war that had cost 5 million lives was finally over, and Vietnam won its independence. So I think there's a reason for all this. Looking to the history of the Vietnam War offers a lot of important lessons for today. Most clearly and obviously, I think it illustrates in great detail that capitalism is an utterly barbaric system and its managers are depraved monsters. The Vietnam War is definitely among the greatest crimes in history, and it was not an accident, it was not a mistake, but really it was the logical outcome of a system that is driven by power and competition. It was started as well, not by a Trump, but by a Kennedy, which is a president equivalent to today's Obama, really. And today, it's pretty clear, we still live in a world that is scarred by war and oppression. The anti-war movement didn't win totally. I think just looking at the supposed American liberation of Mosul last year tells you a bit about the world that we live in. Indeed, as well, often it seems like we are on the brink of total war. The US still dominates the world with ruthless violence, but they're really beginning to panic now about the rise of China. And Donald Trump has his tiny little hands on weapons that could decimate the entire population of the world. But the resistance to the Vietnam War reminds us as well that their order rests on sand and the monster can be stopped. In Vietnam, the greatest military force in the entire world that has ever been seen was beaten by a peasant army and a war within. And I think it's the responsibility of us all to build a movement that can do the same today.